Hello, hello. Glad to have everybody here. Thank you for coming back to us. Hopefully everybody had a long summer and had some time off, some for other reasons. And we have new family members and all sorts of things. But I thought it would be useful, since we do have some new members around the table, to just do a quick around the table introductions of who you are and what organization you represent. For those that don't know me, I'm Judy Resnick. I am retired. I used to be the executive director of CBI's Education Foundation, but have agreed to stay on to help Roberta out in this.
Roberta Willis, State Representative, House Chair of the Higher Education and Employment Advancement Committee.
Representative Whit Betts, I'm the ranking member on the Higher Ed Committee.
Sally Reese, I'm the Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at the University of Connecticut. Nice to see everybody again.
Just in time, Estela Lopez, Interim Provost, the Connecticut State Colleges and University System.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Barzi, the Chief Talent Officer at the State Department of Education, and I'm representing Commissioner Winsel.
Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jen Widnes with the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges. I recently replaced Judy Greiman as the president.
And congratulations.
She just had a baby.
Yes.
Lindy Gold.
A new job and a new baby.
Yeah. Lindy Gold, Connecticut Department of Economic and Community Development. And Judy, you're not retired, you're reinvented.
Dennis Jones, National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, NCHEMS.
Ames McGinnis, NCHEMS.
Vargas Hadjimichael, Professor Emeritus, Fairfield University.
Lois Schneider, Management Consultant.
Carrie Kelly, Office of Policy and Management. I head up the Education and Workforce section in the Budget Division, and I'm here representing Ben Barnes.
I'm Judy Goldfarb. I've been appointed by the governor to sit with this auspicious group, and my background is primarily as a consultant in early childhood.
I'm Booker Devon, President Emeritus, Three Rivers Community College in Norwich.
Thank you. Again, welcome, and glad to have everybody back. And in the start of a new year, we have made a lot of progress. We have a lot to talk about today. So with that, let me ask for people to indicate their approval of the minutes from April 14th, I believe. Second? All those in favor? Opposed? Minutes are thus approved. You should have at your place an agenda for today, and I think it's actually an ambitious one, so I'm going to hope that we really buckle in and get moving here. There's been really, as I indicated, some marvelous progress over the summer. But we will take a look at some legislative updates. We will look at where we're going in terms of the accountability that was really a major part of the strategic plan. We'll talk a bit about the outcomes-based funding initiative, and we will also talk about student financial aid and that particular initiative as well. So with that, let me turn to Roberta and ask her to tell us a bit about the legislative session as it relates to our work here in the Planning Commission.
Well, thank you, everyone. It's nice to, seems like we haven't been together in a long time. And I haven't missed the place, but that's another story. We did very well in terms of the work that came out of this committee and implementing them into legislation. The first thing, and it should be in your package, is the implementation of the Planning Commission's recommendations. So now our strategic plan that we approved is now part of the state statute on state statutes on what the goals are for higher education in Connecticut. And as you can see, it's increased the student adult population education levels, develop a globally competitive workforce in the economy, and ensure higher education affordability. And the new law also requires us to coordinate these goals with the Higher Education Coordinating Council. We'll hear more about that. That's really the Office of Policy and Management and the through the governor that oversee that. And then the legislation also required us to establish a work collaboration with the Office of Policy and Management on several of the issues. And one of them that came out of this committee is the outcomes-based financing. You will see a copy of the Act in front of you, Special Act 15-20. And what this does is establishes a task force on outcomes-based financing to really take the goals that we have established and connect them with policy. And obviously, one way to do that is to connect them to how we finance higher education in Connecticut. So great things that came out of here. I want to thank everybody for their contribution, and Dennis and Ames for helping us with these two pieces of legislation. And with that, I will pass item number five on to Carrie to talk about the sheet that's in here.
So yeah. Before we do that, can I take a moment to thank Roberta for her tireless work? I think for all of you that have labored for a couple of years on our work here at the Planning Commission and the strategic plan, how many times have we all sat around in certain groups and created a plan that sat on a shelf and nothing happened? And I think it is noteworthy, particularly that it isn't that we're just going forward and doing new things. It's that it is now in legislation. And I think that is a tremendous accomplishment, and it doesn't happen easily, particularly in a session as contentious as this last one was. So I wanted to personally, and I hope on behalf of everyone on the committee, thank Roberta for her tireless work in making this stuff happen, and to Dennis and Ames for the guidance that they provided in doing that. So forgive me. Carrie.
Well, I'm happy to report that the Higher Education Coordinating Council will be meeting on October 5th, which is a Monday, from 3 to 4:30 in this room, to receive the report on the metrics developed at the last meeting, which occurred on November 29th, 2012. So if you review this sheet, starting on the side entitled Framework, these are the overarching goals that the Higher Education Coordinating Council adopted. The body is composed of members of the public institutions of higher ed. So it's the leadership, the executive leadership of those institutions or systems, and their governing body head, as well as representation from the executive branch of government. So these were many years in the making, and we identified metrics which are on the backside that align with these goals. So for example, the overall vision, as determined by the Higher Education Coordinating Council, is a continually increasing share of Connecticut's population will have the high-quality post-secondary education that enables them to achieve their life and career goals and make Connecticut a place of engaged, globally competitive communities. On the backside, you can see the metrics that were adopted by the Higher Education Coordinating Council. And we've had, through the hard work of Bill Gammel at the BOR, and other folks at UConn who participated, we have this information that will be presented in the draft report and adopted by the Higher Education Coordinating Council on the 5th. We have the metrics that examine it on a system level and on an institutional level where possible. So out in the back, you can see the metrics for vision. Among the other supporting goals that align with the vision is college readiness, student success, affordability and sustainability, innovation and economic growth, and equity. So you can see all the measures that were identified and will be contained in the report that will be presented. We look forward to it and hope you can join us.
But Carrie, do you also want to, in the package, there's a comparison of I think it's helpful for people to see this where it says goals. And, you know, we've gotten many people asking the questions, the difference between the Planning Commission for Higher Education, you know, the Higher Education Coordinating Council's goals, and then now we have the Outcomes-Based Financing Task Force that has now been formed out of this group. So I want to thank Terry Adams, Office of Legislative Research. I understand that you helped Carrie as well as putting this together. So thank you. Do you want to say anything about the comparison sheet?
Sure, so I'd like to also recognize Shohrab Gua, who's just joined our office and who did a lot of the work and coordinated with Terry. This really, on one side, if you start, align the three higher ed bodies, and there's a lot of commonality and overlap between them. So that's the Planning Commission for Higher Education, which hopefully we're all familiar with, right? The Higher Education Coordinating Council and their goals, and the Outcomes-Based Financing Task Force. And the italicized portions are areas that are interdependent, so information from one body is relied on for the other. On the flip side of that are the metrics that are required to be produced in greater detail. So you can see that they really align in a host of ways and build on each other and have a lot of commonalities. And there's a common thread that goes through this.
Thank you.
That's great. I mean, and hopefully this is also part of this positive energy going forward when we begin to look at the work we've done and the work that's already out there that we're all rowing from the same boat is kind of encouraging. So I'm delighted to do that. With that, let me ask Dennis then to talk about...
Judy, excuse me, just
to work.
I missed the date for the Higher Education Coordinating Council meeting.
Sure, that's October 5th, Monday, October 5th from 3 to 4:30, and it's here in Room 1E of the Legislative Office Building.
Thank you.
We will have the agenda available on the OPM website about a week before, so we're just finalizing that now. We expect to receive the full report, which is fairly voluminous. I don't know, it's probably 100 pages, so very detailed.
Thank you. With that, if there are no other questions, let me turn this over to Dennis then to talk specifically about the metrics that are reflective of the goals of the Planning Commission. Want to turn on your... Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's on. I kind of started from just the report of the Planning Commission and say, here are the goals, and here are some metrics that attach to those, and put those metrics in kind of two buckets, one of which is explicitly tied to the goal, and one of that I would call enabling or supporting metrics that reflect steps that can be taken along the way. So, for example, the goal of the Planning Commission is around education attainment of the adult population. But you get there by graduating more students. So one of the population-based statistic, which is education attainment, is the metric that is reflective of the goal. The degree production is a supporting metric or supporting goal. And when I went through the list that Carrie just laid out versus what I put together, I mean, they're very simpatico. They're overlapping in many ways. So, you know, and I didn't find any areas where I thought there was real conflict. So that's the good news. The other piece of it, however, is the Coordinating Council work is reflective only of the public institutions, and the Planning Commission is about the state. So, you know, the whole question of how one puts the private institutions their contribution to goals into this mix is one piece. that we have to pay some attention to. But I think that really is the major difference, at least between what the Planning Commission has done and what the Coordinating Council has put in its report. I mean, that's, you know, there's a couple of little things that are easily fixed, but in the main, the good news is there's not, you know, we're not marching down separate paths here. So, on the education attainment goal, these are the metrics that are consistent with the plan itself. It's about education attainment of the age 25 to 64-year-old population in the state, with sub-detail around that about attainment gaps between whites and underrepresented minorities, which in the coordinating the council report is under the label of equity, that just runs through all of this. I pulled it out separately. And the one that's not there is the one where we talk about education attainment gaps of the residents of the inner cities in the state versus the rest of the state. But that is, that can, I don't think that's in the way you talked about equity, because equity was underrepresented minorities, gender, and age, I think it is. Am I correct? Yeah. The other piece at the bottom of, you know, and all the way through suggests that we do this for 25 to 34-year-olds as well as 25 to 64-year-olds, just because 25 to 34-year-olds are the ones that are most immediately reached and where the numbers will change most dramatically if progress is really made. And I put in here, because we talked about this so much as the Planning Commission, the trends in the quality of the degrees awarded and the question of the extent to which these degrees really reflect the deeper learning that we talked about and is included specifically in the Planning Commission. And that's one that I've noted. There are no metrics for. We have to figure out a way to get that done. That will be food for additional conversation. The supporting metrics, these are, you know, in the language of the council, it is college readiness. I've broken this down, and we can talk about whether these levels of detail are gettable, and you know, one of them is it in one field, two fields, three fields? Are those levels of deficiencies gettable from the? Okay, because you're only dealing with the two. Okay, but you're not splitting reading and writing, for example. You're just doing math and English. Okay, so that's legit. Okay, we can make these consistent with that. No problem. Okay. And then there's, and then I have in here 1 year, within 1 year of enrolling, you have within 2 years passing the gateway course. And if the data are for 2 years, then you can use 2 years. You can do it either way, and maybe we do both.
Am I correct in assuming that the community colleges, at least, are now prevented from retaining students for 2 years if they can't get through the remedial classes in 1 year?
That I can't answer.
Roberta?
In the past, we've had students in the community colleges for as long as 2 years in remedial courses, which gained them no credits. So we set up basically a three-tiered remediation program for students based on how they tested. The ones that test the highest go into an embedded course, so they get their remediation along with their course. And this way they're gaining credits as they're going along. We heard from students that it was very demoralizing for them to be in college for, you know, more than a year, 2 years, and still not have earned a college credit or made it into a gateway course, introductory course. The next level below that is 1 semester. There are caveats for repeats on that, but then they would be tested after that initial course to see if they're ready then to go into embedded or if they need additional help. And then there's the lowest level, which is probably 10% of the population then tests that they need remediation, and those go into a transitional course. We started out calling it a boot camp, and that those students take that course, and then they move into the remedial course, you know, the next level. And, I mean, obviously the goal is to for students to be successful and to get them into a gateway course. I mean, that is basically, it's not about necessarily whether they graduate or not, but, you know, after completing transitional, can they make it in to be successful in a gateway course. I hope, Lindy, if that, I certainly can provide anyone with more information on how that's working. The embedded courses, I was just having a conversation with Stella and Bill, that they're doing, those students are doing extremely well. I know that the CSU, the 4 university schools, the model has worked very, very well there. The second level is seems to be doing well. Again, we're trying to measure that. But the transitional level obviously is still a challenge, but we don't have, since the way it's being rolled out from college to college is different. So we're hoping to look into that. In fact, we have an organization who is looking into how the programs are doing. But clearly this is an issue that we need to deal with here in Connecticut. I mean, it's a serious issue, the amount of students that need remedial work before they can take college courses. So if we're going to close that achievement gap, developmental ed has to be working. So thank you. Thank you for the question.
And just reflecting on the comment from Bill, it's probably better to, rather than reflect this as 1-2 courses or more than 2, make this English, math, and both is, and that's probably the way you've done it, and that would be both more enlightening and more consistent. So we'll do that. Okay. And then finally on this, because there was attention to the adults, trends on the numbers of adults receiving degrees at the time that they grad, you know, that are 25 or older at time of receipt of degree, and those data are nationally available, so we can get those numbers, and we can do it by kind of by baccalaureate, associate, certificate. Okay. This is the more difficult one. We've got a proposal or two. This is about competitive workforce, but more, and that one's kind of straightforward. It's the regions and communities and partnership, the way the goals are written, that's for which the metrics are harder. But clearly, degrees granted by level in high priority fields, those are straightforward. You can get those and take a look at that over time. This one, Sally, in your Gen X, next gen proposal and report, these are words taken out of that where you talk about trends and new business activity, and I'm presuming that you've got that, you collect that, and that you can provide that on an ongoing basis. Am I? Yeah.
Personal research and effectiveness page, the website.
Okay.
Much of that is public data that's posted regularly and updated regularly.
Okay. And then the partnerships in every region and trends in number of students in community service and et cetera. That one is one where there are no regularly collected data, to my knowledge. but Ames and I, in poking around in this arena, have a suggestion. The Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching produces a classification of institutions. And they identify institutions as intensive research, baccalaureate, master's, and et cetera. But they also have a category in there for institutions basically apply to be identified as community-serving institutions. Okay, and it's the institution has to fill out a fairly extensive description of their community engagement, and at the end of which, you know, if they kind of pass muster, they are identified as community-serving institutions. I haven't yet been able to find out which Connecticut institutions have crossed that bar. I mean, the foundation's website is a little impervious. As you go in and find individual institutions, but I can't find Connecticut generally. But one of the ways to come at this is to say, how many institutions have achieved that designation? That would be a way to get some foot in the door on this particular metric. The alternative is to start a completely new data collection thing that gets fairly complicated.
Another thought might be, since we're talking about certificates as well as degrees, to check with the Department of Labor or the Workforce Investment Boards to see who issue vouchers to accredited training providers and demand that they result in nationally recognized credentials. They're not all public institutions. Many of them are for-profit providers, but that might be an easier way of aggregating some of that information.
Yeah, we can get data on certifications that way.
Right.
But we don't get service learning, or we don't get community engagement with students in that way.
I don't know what goes into that. Maybe Kelly knows. The Corporation for National and Community Service, they have designations about colleges that are active in their communities, and they all get awarded certain tiers. So I don't know what goes into that application, but it might be worth checking.
Yeah, we have the app. We are one of that,
yeah,
those,
no,
and
know.
We have the application, so you could take a look at it. And we also collect data on number of service learning courses. We've been asked by the legislature a couple of times to do reports on how many hours. So we do keep some track of our hours, well over a million and a half hours a year, for example, from UConn students. But we don't have outcome data about that, but we have ours.
Yeah. And I know that public and private, they're acknowledged. I mean, everybody gets some. And OHU might have some of that as well. I know they do awards on that stuff. So, that, I mean, at least that everyone would be measuring
it'd
the same.
It would be common if everybody did the the application's cumbersome. It took a long time.
Yeah.
But we'd be more than happy to share our application with the Board of Regents or any other institution in the state that would like to see it.
Thanks, Alex. Because, you know, this is one we keep talking about, and it really is new data. And every time you talk about this, it becomes pretty onerous, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, because the Carnegie Foundation's application to get considered has multiple pages of questions. And what is kind of daunting is basically under every one of them, explain in 500 words or
less. That's right. Yeah.
This is the equivalent of an accreditation report.
It is. I think there's only just a little bit over 100 institutions nationally that have it, and I do know it took us a lot of time to get it. So I mean, but the metrics might be something that are helpful if we want to gather common metrics across the state.
Okay.
Yeah. Regarding the first one, trends in new business activity, I wonder how one measures that. There is an issue of technology transfer that depends very much on the ability of different institutions to do that. So it's kind of fuzzy how one measures that. The research doesn't always come from Connecticut institutions.
What we did for Next Generation is took a look at partnerships, business partnerships, you know, research enterprise partnerships, opportunities for pharmaceutical companies to work with faculty grants, faculty contracts, new startups, new patents. So that's the information that we gathered for Next Gen Connecticut, as well as, you know, overall research and the benefits of some of that research in stemming and contributing to new business ventures. So that's how we put it together for the legislature. And that, of course, is a public document. It's hard to track because sometimes you don't know the outcome of the work. You know, look at Gatorade. I mean, for example, it takes oftentimes new patents, new ideas take decades. But we certainly, again, Next Generation's a public document. Happy to share how we pulled this together. And the way that we're trying to chart it. We've done a little bit more work as we have been working on our new IPB building and our partnerships that we currently have. But a lot of it is hopefully seeds for the future. You're right.
And again, parts of that can be picked up and done for multiple institutions, so research activity and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, because, you know, the private sector institutions, again, need to be put into the mix as far as the state, the state trajectory on some of these metrics.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I referenced NextGen because somebody in the state at least has been down the path of saying these are variables that are gettable.
Right.
You know, that there are ways to go get them, and so okay. On the supporting metric side, and these are certainly open for amendment, but if we're talking about communities and the extent to which they're livable communities and places where people want to be and et cetera, then there's a couple of metrics that I put in here that says by cities and by region, let's talk about the proportion of the jobs in that area that are living wage jobs that pay more than twice poverty. So, you know, and what are particularly, what are the trends? Are there getting to be more of those kinds of jobs or fewer of those kinds of jobs in either cities or regions? So that's one approach. That's one piece. A question about the net import or export of folks with degrees. Are people that, you know, is there an exporting of baccalaureate and above in particular, because those are the ones that are most portable and where people are more likely to pick up and move? Are people coming into or leaving cities and regions? And you know, these are all indirect measures of kind of quality of life, but I think they're pretty reasonable ones. And then trends in per capita income, particularly in cities, relative to statewide averages. Is it closing the gap, or are some of these places getting further and further behind in overall income levels of the population of the region? Those are the ones that I dragged out and said, I know these are all gettable. So that, you know, one can go to census data and get these data. And so the question is, are they, in your minds, appropriate to the goal we're trying to get at? As I said, this one is the more difficult one.
Yeah, with regard to net import-export of individuals, do you intend to place a cap on age? Do you refer to folks just out of college or in mid-career, or at what point?
I'm talking about the working age population.
From
25 to 64.
Okay, thanks.
And because we use 25 to 64 and 25 to 34-year-olds and other things, I'm not sure we can, I would like to be able to do that. I don't know if the data, well, because census, the American Community Survey, is a sample, I'm not sure that it will let us get to the narrower age group without having an error term that's so big that it makes the data totally unreliable. But we'll look at it.
I heard this morning a demographic report that really talked about the only growth in children right now is in the cities and not in the suburbs, so that will again throw a different light on the demographics that you want to change. Also, that there's going to be a major recruitment to bring people in from out of state to fill the jobs that we have people retiring from currently, and they may be bringing people's ages, and it's more of a professional recruitment, so people who have higher degrees who will be bringing in, and the biggest growth industry will be in funeral homes.
Yeah. And part of the question about the importing of folks with advanced degree, baccalaureate and higher degrees, is what this metric captures. And the question is Connecticut, if it's just replacement, it's one thing, because if somebody, ages out of the population and is replaced by somebody else, the proportion doesn't change. But if there's a net gain by virtue of this, then you want to know it. And that's what this tries to get at. Because we're talking about, in all of these, understand that we're talking about trends, not just a single year data point.
And I think that the pieces on looking at innovations and patents and new jobs is going to be really critical, because the creative economy tells us it's not just creating new things, but creating new jobs.
Yeah.
Because the old jobs won't be there.
And that's part of the piece that's in the, and those pieces are in the next gen, and quite frankly, and I don't know, but is licensure revenue in that metric?
It's projections based on, you know, hiring new faculty in engineering and looking at the prior, looking, for example, at departments that have been successful, pharmaceutical sciences, various engineering departments, some of the biological science departments, et cetera. But we projected with more STEM faculty in areas that we've been successful in the past that we would see increases in those areas.
But, you know, one of the things that I, because patents are one thing, does anybody want to take advantage of them is another, okay? And so filing a patent doesn't necessarily turn into job creation and et cetera, but if somebody is willing to pay for licensing and et cetera, then it's a better indicator of whether these engender economic activity. You know, the problem is you can't confine it to Connecticut. I mean, you may be getting licensure revenue, but it may all be coming from Colorado or from someplace else, and that I haven't found anybody that sorts that one out. But at least it's an indication of the level of innovative activity going on by folks inside the state. Okay?
Dennis, could you describe or define for me what living wage is?
My definition is it pays, it's a wage that pays twice poverty level. So whatever the poverty level is defined to be, the wage, if it pays twice that.
Okay. As opposed to the amount of money you might need to actually live and pay the actual costs where you live.
Yeah, but this is poverty as defined
by the federal government.
But for your region, not necessarily for the U.S. as a whole, because there are variations to this that you can get, not just for Connecticut versus New York, but for parts of Connecticut. Okay.
The one
he's going to straighten me out. After we got past it, he's going to throw out the anchor and slow.
There's a major reason why he's that far away. I just listening to this conversation, I think it's easy to lose track of what the goal actually is. And one of the reasons why we put in the information about the import-export issue was really the impact of the institutions, both public and independent, in this state on actually the quality of life of the communities and regions in which they're located. In other words, by having your institutions deeply engaged in that region, that creates an environment where impact will, in fact, help retain highly educated people. In our interviews around the state, that's just a consistent theme. Obviously, cost of living is a major variable. But is this a place you really want to live? Are there the amenities and other things? And I think there are a lot of contributions, if you really think of the institutions in this state, to the quality of life in the regions that they live. I mean, that was the reason for that, and I just want to underscore that. So it's hard to get a measure of it, but at least some idea. If your really institution is engaged, it ought to be having a positive effect on the people who actually want to come there and stay there, and not only your graduates.
Okay. Affordability. The Coordinating Council talks about tuition relative to median family income. This metric goes another step and talks about cost of attendance relative to income for both the median and for the low quintile families. So it takes the median, that's one thing, but the question then is also how affordable is higher education for families who are at the low end of the economic scale. And pardon me, I've been told I got to talk into the microphone. He had to walk all the way over here to tell me that.
No, Dennis went all the way through the last meeting by giving great speeches, and Jeannie could record none of it for the minute.
Oh, that was by intent. This is still by accident. But we are defining net cost of attendance as the cost of attendance minus grant aid from state institutions and Pell. So, you know, we're talking about what's the gap, and how big is that gap relative to median family income and to low quintile family income. So what proportion of family income has to be spent to pay the gap? Okay, that is the metric that we're suggesting, and it's different for the research universities, the comprehensive institutions, the community colleges, and we don't have in here the privates, but they have to be in here, this has to be public and private. Okay, so both. Okay, that's the. And it's consistent. I mean, the framing is generally consistent with what the coordinating council talks about, except you use tuition, and because tuition is because the deductions for grant aid are a little fuzzy in some ways, that putting in the tuition relative to income is probably a useful addition. Rather than, I wouldn't replace it, but I would put it in as an addition. Yeah.
I don't know how you can really get that metric from the private colleges and institutions, because their scholarships are very different, and it isn't about state aid and Pell grants. It really, in most cases, is about the area of study and whether there's a policy of blind admission. I dare say young people graduating from UConn, for the most part, that are on scholarships graduate with far more debt than those who graduate from Yale with the same.
But at least, you know, for all institutions, we can get, not for all students, but for freshmen, a statement that says, here is the cost, and here's how much for all freshmen comes mm-hmm. from these sources. Okay, so we can get, for public and private institutions, for freshman students.
Yeah.
We can't get it for everybody, and mm-hmm. so, but you can.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's,
I mean, just to plug P20Win and our own work, I mean, CCIC is collecting unit record data or working on it for undergraduate students at private colleges that are agreeing to participate in the project, which is 13 of 15. And so we'll have financial aid data eventually. And we're going to be sharing it with P20Win, which is the data sharing effort that Chan Keeney behind me and Bill Gamble work on it with me. So I think it'll be helpful for us to have a crosswalk at some point of what's available via iPads and what we need through P20Win. That would be really helpful, so that I can make sure that the data that we're collecting that's not available via iPads, that we're getting it.
And it's not additional data as much as it is additional students that are covered by the data, I think, because the iPads is freshman only.
Yeah.
For all of these. I just mean for all of them.
Sally?
So probably good to note that UConn's now also a part of PK21, and also that our average debt at graduation is lower than the national mean. And I'm not sure it's accurate to say it's lower than Yale's. I brought our director of financial aid when I saw the financial aid and the vice president for enrollment management with me. I think we're about 24,000, Wayne, 24,000 average debt at graduation, which is lower than the national mean, and that's with an average 4.2 years to graduation for all of our students. So I don't want to question what you said, but I think that assumption we'd want to take a closer look at. Okay, so.
Cool. Okay.
I did have a question, Dennis. Actually,
yeah.
It's for Carrie. You know, as we collect metrics and the coordinating council, they have their metrics that they're doing. How do we mesh those together like a unified, so we're all measuring the same or similar things, or helping one another? It just seems that...
Right. I think once our report is public and available in October, it'll be a little clearer, but the HECC really is only focused on the public institutions. So I think we'll have to rely on iPads or P20Win. And some of the data is more demographic about statewide issues and not system or institution specific. But I think at that point, we'll need to work with the help of NCHEM to align and see where things are actually the exact same metric is being used, or a very, very similar one, and look where we can try to enhance each other's. I mean, we're bound by the statute for HECC and the things that the members have selected, so we'll have to do that. But I certainly think there's opportunity for us in the HECC to expand what we're doing and also kind of overlay what the Planning Commission's doing and find those areas of commonality and spike them out. So,
Rupert, I just remember helping draft this, and that the reality being that you had the institutions already working on the report that Carrie is just giving. So, you know, the change had not been made in the statute, so we couldn't change the signals. But the thought was going forward with the language,
right?
That would be doing what Carrie's talking about. Does that make sense? So it's
We're working from the metrics that were embraced by the HECC at our last meeting, which occurred in 2012. So there'll need to be a refreshing, certainly.
And that's one where we work back and
right.
forth and
we
come
frequently.
Up with one. You know that. Hopefully cuts across both public and private and gets one kind of annual report out that says, here's how we're doing. And the final ones here, we talked about student loan. Part of this is what proportion graduate with student loan, and you know, an awful lot of the rhetoric around student loans, first of all, includes graduate students and not just undergraduates. And second of all, it masks the notion that an awful lot of students graduate without any loan. And so knowing what proportion of students are borrowing is important. And again, by sector. And then of those that do borrow, how big is the loan? I mean, this is an area where averages just lose an awful lot. So a little more fidelity to getting a fix on this one. There was, I under the supporting or contextual measures, the question of trends in proportion of Connecticut high school graduates who enroll in Connecticut institutions. You know, that was an issue for the Planning Committee. But it also, I think, reflects relative, if the proportion is going up, at least one can make the leap that says that students are finding it more affordable to stay home than it is to leave the state. So this is both a workforce issue about keeping Connecticut students in Connecticut, but it's also one kind of indirect metric on affordability. And then the other metrics are changes in tuition over time, just the part that institutions themselves can control, because the other parts of cost of attendance are room and board and et cetera, and that's only marginally under the control of the institutions. So, you know, and going forward, I'm going to be very interested in getting the report that comes out on the 5th of October, because what I think then we'll do is take some of that, take work that we have done or will do, and come back with something that looks like a first pass at this framework with numbers attached, with some places that say, and here's where we don't have numbers, or we only have numbers for UConn but not some other places, or you know, on the kind of next gen metrics. But that's what I propose. This is the set of data. I think we are very much on the same page with HECC. Where we're not, it won't take much to put us there. And rather than put institutions through another data collection thing, we'll try to accommodate what's already there, and things like college readiness and some of those things. We won't try to invent yet one more metric of that. And we'll use the data that we've got on the population and things that are not institution specific and put together the picture. So that is the end of my comments on this particular topic, unless there are additional questions.
I would just indicate that, as we discussed last year, it's difficult for us to have a sense of what to charge for tuition because we don't know what state appropriations are. You know, things change, and there are sincere efforts made by all the legislatures to do what they can, but that's a function of what happens in the economy and everything else. So planning tuition increases is one of the only things we can control, agreed. However, that's also dependent for the state institutions on knowing, you know, in advance what the state's contribution will be. So I just want to make that. I know you know that. We talked about it last year, but I think it's important to state that in light of your comments.
Yeah,
and we're very grateful for all the state appropriations. I want to make sure I say that. extraordinarily grateful, and you know, do everything we can all the time to thank everybody. But it does make it difficult when we don't know, because it's hard to plan, and there's so many things that are fixed. You know, benefits, for example, salary, contracts.
Okay. Anything else on this topic? If not, thank you.
We have our work cut out for us. But the good news is, I mean, this is huge progress in terms of actually being able to measure what we do. I mean, what's the saying? Go, you cannot improve that which you do not measure. So I think we have a lot of work trying to figure out how and what those are, but I think the start is a good one. So thank you, Dennis. Moving on to the next item about the Outcomes-Based Funding Task Force. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have it or no, we don't?
Tomorrow is, actually, in your packet is the membership list thus far of the outcomes, the task force concerning outcomes-based funding. The charge of, I am co-chairing this with Sue Weiselberg, who is the deputy secretary of OPM. It's missing on the chart there, I just realized. It says deputy sec. We just assume it's Office of Policy and Management. And we will have our first meeting tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Again, this is an outgrowth of, you know, obviously a way of implementing the strategic plan and or a vehicle. And online, Jeannie indicated that online is the work plan for the outcomes-based funding task force. So if you want to go online, we have a website now. I think she sent the links to everyone. So we all, did this committee get it? Okay, well, maybe we could send those out to them in case they want to track it. So they have the link. But information will be on there, the membership list, and additionally will be notes and the scope of work that it's being charged with. So, again, this is an outgrowth of all of your efforts. And we are hoping that we will have this group is a task force, means it has an endpoint. So it's supposed to complete its work before the start of the session. And that way, we're hoping that we will be able to introduce legislation, at least to begin this process. We may not bite the, you know, grapple with the entire issue, but we certainly want to make a start on addressing this issue on outcomes. Okay. Yes, Dennis.
Just, you know, the plan of work that's on the website for this group, just please note that since the first meeting of this group has not yet happened, that is very open to modification, because it is one person's attempt to put down what that plan of work is, and there will undoubtedly be some conversation about that tomorrow that may result in either timing or scope kind of conversation about what gets done by the beginning of the session, for example.
We won't point fingers at any individuals. The next item on our agenda is the subcommittee to develop recommendations regarding student financial aid. Another issue, obviously, a goal of this committee is affordability. We are going to be, there should be in your package the charge to the study in there. And I'm pleased to announce that James Maroney, who is a member of our commission here, has agreed to chair the committee. So we're very excited about that and thank him for his willingness to step up to the plate. Also, Carrie will be assisting from OPM, Sarah Bourne from Office of Fiscal Analysis, along with Alan Shepard. Will also, since they are really knowledgeable about that, the Office of Higher Education, which administers the Governor's Scholarship, will also be a member. And there are several other people who have stepped up to the plate who are involved with financial aid. And so we thank them for their willingness to serve on this committee. We're probably going to be meeting for the first time. James and I have to come up with a date, but probably around the first week of October, that 28th to October 2nd in there. I can't remember. Did we pick a date, James? Okay. Yeah, we're gonna work within that parameter to see which works best. And I also would like to ask, since apparently I wrote down the list of people who stepped up to the plate, I did not pass that information along to Jeannie. And I found that out today. So I don't know where I put that. So I know many of you have given me names. Jen, I believe Gail has for UConn, have given me some names. So we're going to have to recreate that list if you don't mind.
Yeah, we also have someone that's agreed to serve from CCSU. So, I mean, we've made a direct attempt to be very inclusive across all sectors of higher education, and really to bring people to the table that have a great deal of expertise, including the Professional Financial Aid Association for the state. So I think it's going to be a very robust membership.
Jeannie, that was a remark aimed at my organizing abilities. Just because I put the entire committee names on the back of an envelope that's on my desk at home, it shouldn't be a concern to anyone that I'm going to be helping with this committee. So I apologize to all of you who did your homework and got me the names, and I apologize to Jeannie because I thought she had the list. So there we have it. Thank you.
So as you can see, there's been a lot of work done this summer as well as in the legislative session to move the work of the Planning Commission forward. So I know many of us, it was a labor of love for a number of years without seeing a lot of end result. But I think that this is so encouraging, and hopefully it is to all of you as well. So I thank you for your patience and your endurance and your participation. I think we're going to begin to actually really see some good results in the year to come. So if there are no other questions, I do believe we have settled on a date for our Oh, we didn't ask you guys. I forgot. We think we have a date, but we didn't ask the two of you, October 15th, for our next meeting date. So that's a tentative. We will get back to you and let you know, but hopefully Thursday the 15th will be our next Planning Commission meeting. And with that, if there are no other questions, let me adjourn the meeting early for a change. This is pretty cool. Thank you for getting us through this agenda well.
I just want to say Mary Beth, who's over there, and one of our Office of Legislative Research, this is her last day with us, and she's going on maternity leave. So congratulations, and we're going to miss you and look forward to... We need to do everything we can to increase birth rates in the state of Connecticut. You know, given the numbers that we've been given. So, Jen and Mary Beth, thank you for your contribution.
You gave more than you were expected.
To the state of Connecticut. It is most appreciated.